Good morning and welcome. It's September 23rd, 1908. Chicago Cubs were playing against the New York Giants. Back when the New York Giants was a baseball franchise before it moved to San Francisco, they were playing toward the end of the division, basically the competition, the pennant race. They'd moved toward the end of the season, and the two teams were pretty much locked neck and neck to see who would win the division series. In this particular game, it was the bottom of the ninth inning. There were two outs. The Giants were batting last. They had runners on first base and third base. One of those runners, the runner on first base, was a guy by the name of Fred Merkel. And Fred Merkel, he was the youngest player in the National League at this time. He was 19 years old. He normally didn't get a chance to play, normally didn't get a chance to start. But on this particular day, one of the regular starters was sick. And so Fred Merkel got called in to play first base. Well, he finds himself on first base, bottom of the ninth, two outs. The batter gets up for the Giants, hits a single. The runner from third from the Giants team makes his way, crosses home plate. He crosses home plate because the score was tied at 1-1, bottom of the ninth. Giants win. Giants were successful in getting a man across home plate, and Fred Merkel, the young 19-year-old on first base, starts making his way to second base because that's what a base runner does. But when he sees the runner cross home plate, and when he sees the runner from his home team has crossed home plate, and he sees all the fans begin to pour out onto the field, he thinks to himself, well, there's really no reason to continue on. There's really no reason to continue to second base, so he stops. And he makes his way toward the dugout. Well, at that time, apparently in the game of baseball, it was kind of I don't know if the rules were not understood all that clearly or what, but the Chicago Cubs, they realized what had just happened. Fred Merkel, because he didn't go and tag second base, opened himself up to a force out. Long story short, one of the most controversial baseball games ever played. The Chicago Cubs appealed the play. They went and tagged second base. Chicago Cubs went on, they called Fred Merkel out. Consequently, the guy who crossed the plate was out. As a result of that, the Chicago Cubs won the game and later went on to win the division by one game over the New York Giants. Now, I tell you that story because in the game of life, as in kind of the game of baseball, what we do on our journey toward the destination, what we do as we're rounding the bases, is just as important as the destination itself. And here's what I want to talk to you about this morning. For all of us, we have a home plate. We have a destination. And I'm assuming that by the fact that you're here this morning that one of the destinations you have in your life, one of the home plates that you want to make sure you cross is to connect with God, to have a relationship with Him. I mean, probably none of us came here today saying, you know, I'm going to show up for worship service in the morning, but I really hope God ignores me. I really hope God abandons me. I really hope God does not answer any of my prayers. All of us want to have this kind of connectedness with God where we have this sense that He hears us, that He responds to us, that we're connected to Him. I mean, if you've ever had that experience where it seems like your prayers, they never really get above the ceiling, like there's this iron ceiling that separates you from the heavens, you've experienced what I'm talking about, the frustration that goes along with not sensing that you have this connectedness with God. So for all of us here today, that's a destination that we all have in common. That's home plate for us that we all want to cross. We want to come before God. We want to pray to Him. We want to have a connectedness to Him. But here's what I want us to understand. As we're in this series studying Isaiah 58, there are some very important bases along the way to our destination. And if we don't touch those bases, we may find ourselves when we arrive at God's throne, when we arrive at home plate, Him as the umpire, in a sense, saying to us, I'm sorry, but there's something that you've missed along the way. And before we get into talking about what the base is that we can potentially miss, I think it's important for us to understand that for some of us as we come here today, you may come in and you say, you know, I want a deeper connection to God. You know, I want to grow in Him. I want to understand who He is. I want to have this sense that He's near me, that He's with me. I don't want to have this sense that He ignores me or I'm not sure if He answers my prayers or even hears my prayers. None of us want that. But if we're not careful to touch this base that I'm going to talk to you about today, then chances are we may appear and approach before God's throne only to have Him say, you know, there's something that you missed along the way that you need to take care of first. So if you would, open up with me to Isaiah chapter 58. Isaiah chapter 58. Last week, if you were here, we began this series called Closer to Reality. We basically gave just an overview of Isaiah chapter 58. And this morning, I want us to look at verses 2 through 5. In verses 2 through 5, we're going to see a group of people who wanted a connection with God. They wanted to be near to Him, but they had missed a very important base along the way. In verse 2, if you read with me, and as we read verse 2, I want you to see the kind of the universal desire that we find here in the heart of the people of God that I believe is also to a large extent present even within us today. Here's what verse 2, it says, "Yet they seek me," the people of God, "they seek me day by day and delight to know my ways." We could probably translate that, they wake up and have their morning devotion. You know, they show up for worship service. They may put a little money into the offering plate. They are mindful of me, you know, as they go throughout the course of their day. These people, they seek me day by day and delight to know my ways. They have studied about me, perhaps. They've read a book about systematic theology, you know. They have this devotional guide by Oswald Chambers that they follow religiously. They seek me day by day. They delight to know my ways. As a nation that has done righteousness and has not forsaken the ordinance of their God, they ask me for just decisions. They come and pray to me. They appeal to me. If this group of people were in our day, they would be a group of people that it would be true of them that they took the Lord's Prayer seriously, that we are to go to our Father in heaven and ask Him for things. It says they delight in the nearness of God. Get this picture here. They want to be close to Him. They desire to be near to Him. They delight in that. They want to have this connection to Him. And I'm assuming at this stage, as we look through this passage, we would all hopefully see, yes, that's me. You know, sometimes I don't always feel near to God, but that's what I want. That's my heart's desire. Because when the Holy Spirit is planted within us, He gives us a desire for God. And we have that in common with them. But here's their we see their desire in verse 2, but in verse 3, we see their disappointment, their frustration. They say, "Why have we fasted and you do not see? Why have we humbled ourselves and you don't notice?" Translation here, why have we ran around all these bases only to get to your throne and you not hear us? Why have I given up food? I mean, why have I gone through the spiritual motions? Why have I showed up early to attend a worship service? Why have I done my morning devotional? Why have I gone through my prayer time? Why have I gone through my daily Bible reading? Why have I done these things? And yet you, God, my Father, who are supposed to be one who longs to give good gifts to your children, you, God, who are supposed to be one who is there ready to answer every prayer I offer to you, for some reason, you don't even see. For some reason, you're not even aware of all these spiritual activities, these spiritual motions that I'm going through to approach your throne. I mean, don't you realize, God, that in order for me to get to home, I've had to cross all these bases. I've had to run really hard. I've had to fast. I've had to pray. The preacher even guilted me into giving some of my money last week. You know, I've been doing all this stuff. But yet, for some reason, you're not even aware of this. You don't even see this. That would raise this huge question, why? Why would God not be responsive to the prayers of the people? Not just the prayers of the people, but the fasting of the people. What they referred to as being in sackcloth and ashes. They're prostrating themselves before God in an act of humility. Why would God not respond to that? I would say that there could be a variety of reasons why God is not responsive immediately to our prayers. Oftentimes it may be that He just wants to grow our faith. He wants to develop us. He wants to mature us. And that very well may be the place that you find yourself in today. It may be that God has something that He wants to do in you, and He wants to do through you, and so that's the reason you don't sense a responsiveness. But it may very well be that you didn't touch the base that He's about to tell us about. Look with me in verses 3b through 5. We find here the root reason why God was not responsive to their prayers. He says, behold, on the day of your fast, you find your desire. You drive hard all your workers. Behold, you fast for contention and strife and to strike with a wicked fist. You do not fast like you do today to make your voice heard on high. Is it a fast like this which I choose? A day for a man to humble himself? Is it for bowing one's head like a reed and spreading out sackcloth and ashes as a bed? Will you call this a fast, even an acceptable day to the Lord? If you're taking notes this morning, I'd like for you to write this down. Here's the root issue that they had. These people acknowledged God. They prayed to God, they fasted, they spread out sackcloth and ashes, they went to the temple. These people acknowledged God, but they ignored His people in need. The Israelites, in a sense, it's as if they thought that they could hit a home run, cross home plate, simply by going through a lot of spiritual activities. But yet what we find throughout the book of Isaiah is that because the people of God turned their eyes away from the people who were in need, God, in a sense, turned His eyes away from them. Not that He cut them off or no longer cared about them, but there was a blockage in the pipeline between their relationship together. And one of the things I think is helpful for us to draw from this, when we realize that the root issue, the base they didn't touch, was that they had acknowledged God, but they had ignored His people in need. Here's the truth. All of us, to a person, have the potential to miss that same base. All of us have the potential to think that our relationship with God is sort of one-dimensional. It's all about my walk with God and my relationship with God and my personal private connection to Him. But yet what we find in the Scriptures, and I would argue that this is from the Old Testament to the end of the New Testament, that our relationship with God is to a large extent influenced and affected by our relationship with people. Our horizontal relationships with others have a direct impact on our vertical relationship with God. For instance, think of it like this, if you parents, if you were at a basketball game, you're out there and you're watching your child play the game, and you know they didn't pass the ball to somebody's kid. And the parent of that kid rose up from the stands and say, you selfish little player, why don't you pass the ball to my child? And that parent stands up and yells it out, and you just kind of grit your teeth. You're supposed to be like Jesus, and Jesus wouldn't go and punch somebody, so you probably shouldn't go and punch somebody right now. So you just hold it in, and then the next time down the court, that same parent yells up and stands up and yells something at your child again. How long is it going to take you to want to go over and just explode on that person? To say, you idiot, how dumb could you be to yell at a kid who's out there on the court who's just a kid? They're 14 years old and you're treating them like they're some adult. It wouldn't take you very long at all to just have this in you that rises up and say, I want to go and punch you out. Right? I mean, can we at least be honest that that might be something that would cross your mind? You may not do it, but hey, that would drive us crazy. And so imagine this scenario. Imagine if that parent, and some of you right now, you probably got, ooh, I know who, this is the parent that I would want to go and punch right now. But imagine that it was that parent that after they do this, they just kind of, ridicule your child out there, and they stand up at the end of the game, and they come up to you and say, hey, we're going to go grab pizza after the game. I just wanted to see if you would come along with us because, we'd just love to have your company. We like being near you. We like having you around. We like knowing that you're kind of there for us. In that situation, what would your response tend to be? You say, oh, hold on, there's something that we're not understanding here. If you're going to treat my child like that, how could you honestly expect me as that child's parent to say, okay, yeah, yell at them, treat them like a dog, ignore them, do whatever to them, and then just come before you and things are going to be fine between us? You see, if we acknowledge God, but we ignore the needs of His people, I wonder sometimes, would God be like a heavenly Father who says, you know what, it's great that you're coming before me. It's great that you're seeking me. But I wonder if there's something in the holy, righteous character of God that would say to us, how dare you? How dare you ignore the needs of my children? How dare you turn a blind eye? How dare you harden your heart and yet think at the same time that you can come before my throne and get whatever you want from me? Here's what I want us to draw away from this passage. Here's what I want us to draw away from this sermon. If we want to open up that pipeline of God's grace, we want to open up that connection between Him to receive an answer to prayer, sometimes we need to be an answer to prayer. The root challenge these people had right here is that they were coming expecting to receive something from God, but they weren't willing to be anything to anyone else. And see, if you're like me, we're really studying in this entire series this idea of social justice, that we as a body of Jesus need to do what we can do to help meet the physical needs of people so that people can see that the gospel is a beautiful, rich thing that affects all of life. And for some of us here, we might be tempted to, in frustration, when we see needs that exist in other parts of the world, cry out to God and say, God, why don't you do something about that? God, in a season, you could bring rain. God, in a season, you could bring transformation physically. God, in a season, you could rain down manna from heaven to provide for the needs of the people. God, why don't you get off your throne and get busy working in this world? And I wonder if God on high would say to us, I gave you the resources. I gave you the seed. I gave you the supplies. I gave you everything that you need to make a difference in this world around you. And the evangelical church in America, you, if you were to be a country, you would be the 7th richest country in the world. I've given it to you. Don't cry out to me and complain to me and gripe to me that I'm not doing something. I gave it to you, church. And the church in North America, one of the things that I pray to God the church will see is that He's blessed us to be a blessing. He's given to us so that we can give to others. And how dare us come before Him and complain and say, God, you're not doing this for me. God, you're not working on my behalf. God would have every right, He would have every bit of vindication to come before us and simply reply, I've given you everything that you need and an incredibly abundant amount more to make a difference in the world. And see, for some of us, and I hope this hits you the way it hits me, for some of us, if we want our prayers to start rising higher, they need to start running deeper. They need to move beyond just the prayer of me and mine. They need to move beyond just what I see in my vision and my world around me. We need to broaden our eyes. And the heart and the hope of this entire series is, again, remember, if reality is defined by people who are living in some of the worst conditions in the entire world, people who are in extreme poverty, people who live on $1.25 a day or less, they don't have the basic necessities like food and water and medicine and those sorts of things. If that's reality here, and we, many of us, are living multiple layers away from that reality, separated from them by the common necessities of life, separated from them by luxuries, separated from them by comforts. The whole hope is that for all of us, when we see people who are living far away from reality over there, and we're living in our reality here, that all of us would say after these 4 weeks are over, that I have moved closer to reality. I have moved closer to an understanding of what God sees when He looks at this world around Him. It's a beautiful thing. All of us can do it. All of us can do it. Every person here can in time say, you know what, I've got issues. Yeah, you know what, I have challenges. But by God's grace, I'm moving closer to reality. Every person here. There's not an excuse. There's not a reason for any person here to walk out and say, you know what, well, yeah, just, I don't know, let the people do whatever they're going to do over in that other country. All of us can move closer to reality. And I pray that all of us do. Last week, I shared with you that one of the things that we're spotlighting in this series is this Horn of Africa drought that's taking place. 11 million, 12 million, I've heard it's about 12.5 million now, people who are affected kind of immediately in the Somalia region and then out to Kenya and Ethiopia and the surrounding countries. And I came to you last week as a church and I said, what are we going to do about it? I was visiting with Lori this past week, and I asked her about the offering. And I wanted to come and share with you today that tomorrow we're going to be sending a check on behalf of you for $2,937 for the first week of this offering. This is 3,000 children who are going to get fed and watered. This is 600 immunization shots for kids who otherwise might die because they don't have basic cares. This is 100 children who could get sponsored for an entire month through Compassion International or World Vision. We're going to give this check. 100% of these proceeds are going to go directly to an organization that gives 100% of their proceeds to the Horn of Africa crisis. And I just want to come today, church, and say thank you. And celebrate the fact that you've risen up. Celebrate the fact that we are taking seriously this call to move closer to reality, to open up our eyes, to no longer hide ourselves from our own flesh. Do you realize that by what you've done here, you're making a difference in the lives of people that you may never see until one day when you get into eternity and a little boy walks up? And so you probably have no clue what you did. You have no clue what you gave, but I just want to tell you that because of what you did, because of your generosity, it made a difference in my life eternally. So we're going to continue to take up this offering for the next several weeks. But I was having a conversation with a friend of mine, and this past week after Sunday's sermon, you might could tell I was just a little bit, a little angst in me. And anyway, I walked away a bit discouraged, because it was like there was a sense of heaviness where we all understand the problem, and yet the need is so incredibly great. The need is so vast that we probably all ask ourselves, what can we do? You know, we just leave with a sense of this burden, this sense of guilt. And I came into my office on Monday, and just rough night on Sunday, and just working through a lot of things. And in my box, there was this card. And this card had the words on it, 58. And if you know me very well, I'm not the kind who says, you know, my car broke down, so, you know, the devil attacked my car and that kind of thing. But when I looked at this, I believe this was a letter from God. That in His timing, in His providence, He brought before my eyes. Because in this letter right here, it talks about a global initiative. It talks about a worldwide movement that is taking place right now. And I want you to, for those of you who may have left last week thinking, what can be done? What can we do? I think this is the answer to that question. This is the answer to that prayer. I'm going to show you a video. It's about 8.5 minutes long. But if you'll take what is shared in this video to heart, I think it has the potential to literally change the world. If we would show it.
The biggest reason the poor are still with us is simply this. We expect that they should be. I mean, I wonder if we lack the imagination, if we lack the hope that the world could be dramatically different. The good news is we can be released from the tyranny of our low expectations. We can be free from that lie that the future will somehow be like our past. The truth is, Extreme global poverty can be overthrown by our generation. But maybe you're a realist. You're a little skeptical. I mean, you may believe that it's possible in theory, but you kind of doubt that it could be accomplished anytime soon. I mean, the statistics are overwhelming. 164,000 children died of measles in a single year. 881,000 people were killed by malaria. 1.4 billion people struggle to live in extreme poverty. That's surviving on less than $1.25 per day. But you know, measles doesn't kill people. Malaria doesn't kill people. A lack of food or clean water, they don't kill people. Even most natural disasters, they rarely kill people. There is one single killer responsible for all of these deaths: extreme poverty. Poverty is the difference between a $5 latte with an extra shot or a $5 shot that will protect a child from dying of measles. Poverty is the difference between an earthquake in Los Angeles killing 63 people and an earthquake of similar magnitude in Haiti killing 220,000 people. Wherever poverty has a stronghold, the statistics are grim. I recently spoke at a pastor's conference. I asked these church leaders, these pastors, to write down one verse, the first verse that came to their mind about poverty or about the poor. You want to guess what the most common answer was? The poor will always be with you. Jesus said those words right after Mary poured a $45,000 jar of perfume on his feet. And Judas, you know, Judas Iscariot, the greedy little treasurer, he saw that money dripping on the floor, dripping on that dirt, and he objected, and he said, "Why this waste? This perfume could have been sold and the money given to the poor. It was worth a year's wages." So Jesus then turns to Judas, the keeper of the purse, and he says, "You will always have the poor with you, but you will not always have me." Well, wait a second. Let's look at that again. You will not always have me? We will not always have Jesus? But later he says, "I will be with you always." Which is it? We know the answer. How can we treat the first half of this sentence like an all-time proclamation and we put the second half in context? I mean, who is the you? Jesus didn't say the poor would always be with us. Jesus didn't somehow ordain economic poverty because he wasn't talking to us. He was talking to Judas. When Jesus prayed, "Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven," it wasn't some cliche fit for a greeting card. It was his driving ambition for his kingdom. And God does not want people to suffer in economic poverty. God does not intend for people to die of preventable diseases. God clearly and repeatedly has commanded us to care for the poor, and God has given us everything we need to end extreme poverty. Here is the astounding truth. The tyranny of extreme poverty is being broken. In the past 8 years, the number of kids dying from measles has dropped by 78%. 22 countries have cut their malaria rate in half, and they did it in only 6 years. You know, we used to say that 40,000 children die every day from preventable causes. In the 90s, that number dropped from 40,000 to 33,000 per day, and in 2008, it dropped again to 24,000, and now we're down to 21,000. We cut that number in half in a generation. I'd like to take you back 200 years to 1810. We had an average lifespan of 30 years, and almost all of us were living in extreme economic poverty, but things begin to change. Industrialization starts to happen in Europe, and the economies are growing, and as they're making more money, they're able to secure more quality food, and they're living longer, they're living healthier. And in that time, we discover electricity, and we invent the automobile, and airplanes, and vaccines, and soon the rest of the world is following. And as you look across that whole span of time, you see this momentum, the sense that we are heading somewhere. Even those countries that we look at today and think, "Oh, it's just not possible," they are all following this path out of extreme poverty and into a new place. You remember that massive number that I gave you earlier, the number of people living in extreme poverty, 1.4 billion? Well, listen to this. I mean, if you're only going to remember one set of numbers from all this stuff I'm telling you, remember this: 52 to 26 and 26 to go. In 1981, 52% of the world's population lived in extreme poverty. Today, that number is 26%. We've cut the percentage of people living in extreme poverty in half, and we did it in a generation. If that's what the generation before ours did, just imagine what our generation can do. There are 138 million Christians in America who attend church regularly and say their faith is very important to them. Collectively, we earn $2.5 trillion per year. We would be the seventh richest country in the world. If we were a country, we'd have a seat at the G8. God has given us amazing wealth and influence. Question is, what are we going to do with it? What could we do with it? You know, in Isaiah 58, we find God's people. They are trying, now they're begging to receive blessings from the Lord. But they're exploiting their workers, and they're fighting with each other. They're bickering, and they're complaining that their sacrifices haven't been noticed by God, and that their fasting has been overlooked. But Isaiah, the prophet, he steps into that, and he says, you want God to honor your sacrifices? Well, this is what you need to do. It's time to loose the chains of injustice. It's time to set the oppressed free. I believe the message of Isaiah 58 is the same message that we need to hear again today. No more idle words. Martin Luther King Jr. once said, human progress never rolls in on the wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts of men willing to be co-workers with God. It's time for authentic action. Let's stop performing out of religious habits and start living the life we were called to. The poor will not always be with us. We do not need to live in a world where children die from preventable diseases. Extreme poverty and all the suffering it brings can be pushed into the history books. And God has given us the mandate and every resource that we need to accomplish that task. He has entrusted us with money, with knowledge, with influence, and with a brief amount of time on this earth, a brief amount of time in which to make a difference. Ending extreme poverty is our generation's greatest opportunity to join the ranks of those who fought for the end of the slave trade, to stand with those who worked for equal rights in the generations before ours. And we are asking you to join this march, not because you need to, not from duty, not out of guilt, not with any reluctance, but because you want to, because you were made for this. Poverty has a solution. It is the true fast of Isaiah 58. When we fast, we give up something good for the sake of something great, like giving up food in order to focus on prayer. What fast will you choose? Go to live58.org and choose your fast. Commit to your strategy in the great cause of ending poverty.
There are a couple of ways to kind of get involved and broaden our horizons, to get closer to reality. One is that we are taking up this offering, but there is another way. And if we could go ahead and bring that website up, just show kind of a shot of that. It's within the PowerPoint, I believe. We're going to show you just in a minute what this basically looks like. If you want to go to this website, you can join this movement, this live58.org movement. If you see here, this is basically a shot of that web page. Live58.org is where you can go. If you see at the lower left-hand corner, there's a little tab there that says sign up now. There are all kinds of ways that you can get involved in this. There are all kinds of ways that you can move closer to reality. We're going to be spotlighting some more of these as we walk through the rest of this series. Let me close with this today. For some of you, if you're like me, one of the concerns you have with somebody just talking about ending extreme poverty and helping people through physical means is that it sort of begins to sound maybe a little bit like the social gospel. And what I mean by that is just like, well, make everybody's life better here in the here and now and then forget about their life in the hereafter. One of the things that we're making very sure that we do is to partner with groups who are gospel-centered, who are Christ-centered, so that we're not just doing humanitarian aid, which, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that, but humanitarian aid is, I don't believe, ever intended to be an end in itself. We have an opportunity here through doing what we're doing to adorn the gospel of Jesus. Specifically, the offering we're taking is going to go to the Horn of Africa, the country of Somalia. A friend of mine sent me an email this past week and said, hey, here's some facts you probably would want to know about this area. And she said that less than 1% of the population in Somalia is evangelical, is Christian. But if you go over one country to Kenya, some 35% of the people there are Christians. And one country over in Uganda, there are some 40%+ of the people who are Christians. And what we find there is that because of this drought, many of the people are being pushed out of Somalia into areas where there is an openness to the gospel. And so what I want you to leave with today is an understanding that as we seek to meet these physical needs in people, God, I believe, is going to join with us, or God is already on board with this, to meet their spiritual needs. So let's pray together, and we're going to basically just have a time to respond through giving. If you want to give, you can give just right out of manual. Make sure you designate Horn of Africa, and that check will be given to the Horn of Africa. So let's pray, and then we're going to sing. So.